official girl who has nothing to do with me. What did Peter say about me? Whenever I saw you, you were surrounded by a flock of girls and at least two boys. You were always laughing, and you were always the center of attention. He was right. What's remained of that Anne Frank? Oh, I haven't forgotten how to laugh or toss off a remark. I'm just as good, if not better, at raking people over the coals, and I can still flirt and be amusing, if I want to be. But there's the catch. I'd like to live that seemingly carefree and happy life for an evening, a few days, a week. At the end of that week, I'd be exhausted and would be grateful to the first person to talk to me about something meaningful. I want friends, not admirers. People who respect me for my character and my deeds, not my flattering smile. The circle around me would be much smaller, but what does that matter, as long as they're sincere? In spite of everything, I wasn't altogether happy in 1942. I often felt I'd been deserted, but because I was on the go all day long, I didn't think about it. I enjoyed myself as much as I could, trying consciously or unconsciously to fill the void with jokes. Looking back, I realize that this period of my life has irrevocably come to a close. My happy-go-lucky, carefree school days are gone forever. I don't even miss them. I've outgrown them. I can no longer just kid around, since my serious side is always there. I see my life up to New Year's 1944 as if I were looking through a powerful magnifying glass. When I was at home, my life was filled with sunshine. Then, in the middle of 1942, everything changed overnight. The quarrels, the accusations. I couldn't take it all in. I was caught off guard, and the only way I knew to keep my bearings was to talk back. The first half of 1943 brought crying spells, loneliness, and the gradual realization of my faults and shortcomings, which were numerous and seemed even more so. I filled the day with chatter, tried to draw Pym closer to me, and failed. This left me on my own to face the difficult task of improving myself so I wouldn't have to hear their reproaches, because they made me so despondent. The second half of the year was slightly better. I became a teenager and was treated more like a grown-up. I began to think about things and to write stories, finally coming to the conclusion that the others no longer had anything to do with me. They had no right to swing me back and forth like a pendulum on a clock. I wanted to change myself in my own way. I realized I could manage without my mother, completely and totally, and that hurt. But what affected me even more was the realization that I was never going to be able to confide in father. I didn't trust anyone but myself. After New Year's, the second big change occurred. My dream, through which I discovered my longing for a boy, not for a girlfriend, but for a boyfriend. I also discovered an inner happiness underneath my superficial and cheerful exterior. From time to time, I was quiet. Now I live only for Peter, since what happens to me in the future depends largely on him. I lie in bed at night after ending my prayers with the words, Ich danke dir für all das Gute und Liebe und Schöne. And I'm filled with joy. I think of going into hiding, my health, and my whole being as Das Gute. Peter's love, which is still so new and fragile and which neither of us dares to say aloud. The future, happiness, and love as Das Liebe. The world, nature, and the tremendous beauty of everything. All that splendor as Das Schöne. At such moments, I don't think about all the misery, but about the beauty that still remains. This is where Mother and I differ greatly. Her advice in the face of melancholy is, think about all the suffering in the world and be thankful you're not part of it. My advice is, go outside, to the country, enjoy the sun and all nature has to offer. Go outside and try to recapture the happiness within yourself. Think of all the beauty in yourself and in everything around you and be happy. I don't think Mother's advice can be right. Because what are you supposed to do if you become part of the suffering? You'd be completely lost. On the contrary, beauty remains, even in misfortune. If you just look for it, you discover more and more happiness and regain your balance. A person who's happy will make others happy. A person who has courage and faith will never die in misery. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, March 8th, 1944. Margot and I have been writing each other notes, just for fun, of course. Anne, it's strange, but I can only remember the day after what has happened the night before. For example, I suddenly remembered that Mr. Dussel was snoring loudly last night. It's now 2:45 on Wednesday afternoon, and Mr. Dussel is snoring again, which is why it flashed through my mind, of course. When I had to use the potty, I deliberately made more noise to get the snoring to stop. Margot, which is better, the snoring or the gasping for air? Anne, the snoring's better, because it stops when I make noise, without waking the person in question. What I didn't write to Margot, but what I'll confess to you, dear Kitty, is that I've been dreaming of Peter a great deal. The night before last, I dreamed I was skating right here in our living room with that little boy from the Apollo ice skating rink. He was with his sister, the girl with the spindly legs, who always wore the same blue dress. I introduced myself, overdoing it a bit, and asked him his name. It was Peter. In my dream, I wondered just how many Peters I actually knew. Then I dreamed we were standing in Peter's room, facing each other beside the stairs. I said something to him. He gave me a kiss, but replied that he didn't love me all that much, and that I shouldn't flirt. In a desperate and pleading voice, I said, "I'm not flirting, Peter." When I woke up, I was glad Peter hadn't said it after all. Last night, I dreamed we were kissing each other. But Peter's cheeks were very disappointing. They weren't as soft as they looked. They were more like father's cheeks, the cheeks of a man who already shaves. Friday, March 10th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, the proverb, "Misfortunes never come singly," definitely applies to today. Peter just got through saying it. Let me tell you all the awful things that have happened and that are still hanging over our heads. First, Meep is sick as a result of Hank and Aggie's wedding yesterday. She caught cold in the Vesterkirk where the service was held. Second, Mr. Kleiman hasn't returned to work since the last time his stomach started bleeding, so Bep's been left to hold down the fort alone. Third, the police have arrested a man whose name I won't put in writing. It's terrible not only for him, but for us as well, since he's been supplying us with potatoes, butter, and jam. Mr. M, as I'll call him, has 5 children under the age of 13 and another on the way. Last night we had another little scare. We were in the middle of dinner when suddenly someone knocked on the wall next door. For the rest of the evening we were nervous and gloomy. Lately, I haven't been at all in the mood to write down what's been going on here. I've been more wrapped up in myself. Don't get me wrong. I'm terribly upset about what's happened to poor, good-hearted Mr. M, but there's not much room for him in my diary. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I was in Peter's room from 4:30 to 5:15. We worked on our French and chatted about one thing and another. I really look forward to that hour or so in the afternoon, but best of all is that I think Peter's just as pleased to see me. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, March 11th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I haven't been able to sit still lately. I wander upstairs and down and then back again. I like talking to Peter, but I'm always afraid of being a nuisance. He's told me a bit about the past, about his parents and about himself, but it's not enough. And every 5 minutes I wonder why I find myself longing for more. He used to think I was a real pain in the neck, and the feeling was mutual. I've changed my mind. But how do I know he's changed his? I think he has, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have to become the best of friends. Although, as far as I'm concerned, it would make our time here more bearable. But I won't let this drive me crazy. I spend enough time thinking about him, and don't have to get you all worked up as well, simply because I'm so miserable. Sunday, March 12th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, things are getting crazier here as the days go by. Peter hasn't looked at me since yesterday. He's been acting as if he's mad at me. I'm doing my best not to chase after him and to talk to him as little as possible, but it's not easy. What's going on? What makes him keep me at arm's length 1 minute and rush back to my side the next? Perhaps I'm imagining that it's worse than it really is. Perhaps he's just moody like me, and tomorrow everything will be all right again. I have the hardest time trying to maintain a normal facade when I'm feeling so wretched and sad. I have to talk, help around the house, sit with the others, and above all, act cheerful. Most of all, I miss the outdoors and having a place where I can be alone for as long as I want. I think I'm getting everything all mixed up, Kitty, but then I'm in a state of utter confusion. On the one hand, I'm half crazy with desire for him, can hardly be in the same room without looking at him, and on the other hand, I wonder why he should matter to me so much and why I can't be calm again. Day and night, during every waking hour, I do nothing but ask myself, have you given him enough chance to be alone? Have you been spending too much time upstairs? Do you talk too much about serious subjects he's not yet ready to talk about? Maybe he doesn't even like you. Has it all been your imagination? But then why has he told you so much about himself? Is he sorry he did? And a whole lot more. Yesterday afternoon, I was so worn out by the sad news from the outside that I lay down on my divan for a nap. All I wanted was to sleep and not have to think. I slept until 4, but then I had to go next door. It wasn't easy, answering all Mother's questions and inventing an excuse to explain my nap to Father. I pleaded a headache, which wasn't a lie, since I did have one, on the inside. Ordinary people, ordinary girls, teenagers like myself, would think I'm a little nuts with all my self-pity. But that's just it. I pour my heart out to you, and the rest of the time, I'm as impudent, cheerful, and self-confident as possible, to avoid questions and keep from getting on my own nerves. Margot is very kind and would like me to confide in her, but I can't tell her everything. She takes me too seriously, far too seriously, and spends a lot of time thinking about her loony sister, looking at me closely whenever I open my mouth and wondering, is she acting, or does she really mean it? It's because we're always together. I don't want the person I confide in to be around me all the time. When will I untangle my jumbled thoughts? When will I find inner peace again? Yours, Anne. Tuesday, March 14th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, it might be amusing for you, though not for me, to hear what we're going to eat today. The cleaning lady is working downstairs, so at the moment, I'm seated at the Van Dan's oilcloth-covered table with a handkerchief sprinkled with fragrant pre-war perfume pressed to my nose and mouth. You probably don't have the faintest idea what I'm talking about, so let me begin at the beginning. The people who supply us with food coupons have been arrested. So we have just our 5 black market ration books. No coupons, no fats and oils. Since Meep and Mr. Kleiman are sick again, Bep can't manage the shopping. The food is wretched, and so are we. As of tomorrow, we won't have a scrap of fat, butter, or margarine. We can't eat fried potatoes for breakfast, which we've been doing to save on bread. So we're having hot cereal instead. And because Mrs. Van D thinks we're starving, we bought some half and half. Lunch today consists of mashed potatoes and pickled kale. This explains the precautionary measure with the handkerchief. You wouldn't believe how much kale can stink when it's a few years old. The kitchen smells like a mixture of spoiled plums, rotten eggs, and brine. Ugh, just the thought of having to eat that muck makes me want to throw up. Besides that, our potatoes have contracted such strange diseases that one out of every 2 buckets of pomme de terre winds up in the garbage. We entertain ourselves by trying to figure out which disease they've got, and we've reached the conclusion that they suffer from cancer, smallpox, and measles. Honestly, being in hiding during the 4th year of the war is no picnic. If only the whole stinking mess were over. To tell you the truth, the food wouldn't matter so much to me if life here were more pleasant in other ways. But that's just it. This tedious existence is starting to make us all disagreeable. Here are the opinions of the 5 grown-ups on the present situation. Children aren't allowed to have opinions, and for once I'm sticking to the rules. Mrs. Van Dan. I'd stopped wanting to be queen of the kitchen long ago, but sitting around doing nothing was boring, so I went back to cooking. Still, I can't help complaining. It's impossible to cook without oil, and all those disgusting smells make me sick to my stomach. Besides, what do I get in return for my efforts? Ingratitude and rude remarks. I'm always the black sheep. I get blamed for everything. What's more, it's my opinion that the war is making very little progress. The Germans will win in the end. I'm terrified that we're going to starve, and when I'm in a bad mood, I snap at everyone who comes near.
Mr. Van Dan, I just smoke and smoke and smoke. Then the food, the political situation, and Carly's moods don't seem so bad. Carly's a sweetheart. If I don't have anything to smoke, I get sick. Then I need to eat meat. Life becomes unbearable, nothing's good enough, and there's bound to be a flaming row. My Carly's an idiot.
Mrs. Frank, food's not very important, but I'd love a slice of rye bread right now, because I'm so hungry. If I were Mrs. Van Dan, I'd have put a stop to Mr. Van Dan smoking long ago. But I desperately need a cigarette now, because my head's in such a whirl. The Van Dans are horrible people. The English may make a lot of mistakes, but the war is progressing. I should keep my mouth shut and be grateful I'm not in Poland.
Mr. Frank, everything's fine. I don't need a thing. Stay calm. We've got plenty of time. Just give me my potatoes and I'll be quiet. Better set aside some of my rations for Bep. The political situation is improving. I'm extremely optimistic.
Mr. Dussel, I must complete the task I've set for myself. Everything must be finished on time. The political situation is looking good. It's impossible for us to get caught. Me, me, me. Yours, Anne.
Thursday, March 16th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, whew, released from the gloom and doom for a few moments. All I've been hearing today is, if this and that happens, we're in trouble. And if so-and-so gets sick, we'll be left to fend for ourselves. And if, well, you know the rest. Or at any rate, I assume you're familiar enough with the residents of the annex to guess what they'd be talking about. The reason for all the ifs is that Mr. Kugler has been called up for a 6-day work detail. Bep is down with a bad cold and will probably have to stay home tomorrow. Meep hasn't gotten over her flu, and Mr. Kleiman's stomach bled so much he lost consciousness. What a tale of woe! We think Mr. Kugler should go directly to a reliable doctor for a medical certificate of ill health, which he can present to the city hall in Hilversum. The warehouse employees have been given a day off tomorrow, so Bep will be alone in the office. If, there's another if, Bep has to stay home, the door will remain locked and we'll have to be as quiet as mice so the keg company won't hear us. At 1 o'clock, Jan will come for half an hour to check on us poor forsaken souls, like a zookeeper. This afternoon, for the first time in ages, Jan gave us some news of the outside world. You should have seen us gathered around him. It looked exactly like a print, at grandmother's knee. He regaled his grateful audience with talk of, what else? Food. Mrs. P., a friend of Meep's, has been cooking his meals. The day before yesterday, Jan ate carrots with green peas. Yesterday, he had the leftovers. Today, she's cooking marrow fat peas, and tomorrow, she's planning to mash the remaining carrots with potatoes. We asked about Meep's doctor.
Doctor, said Jan. What doctor? I called him this morning and got his secretary on the line. I asked for a flu prescription and was told I could come pick it up tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. If you've got a particularly bad case of flu, the doctor himself comes to the phone and says, stick out your tongue and say, ah, oh, I can hear it. Your throat's infected. I'll write out a prescription and you can bring it to the pharmacy. Good day. And that's that. Easy job he's got. Diagnosis by phone. But I shouldn't blame the doctors. After all, a person has only 2 hands, and these days there are too many patients and too few doctors. Still, we all had a good laugh at Jan's phone call. I can just imagine what a doctor's waiting room looks like these days. Doctors no longer turn up their noses at the poorer patients, but at those with minor illnesses. Hey, what are you doing here? They think. Go to the end of the line. Real patients have priority.
Yours, Anne. Thursday, March 16th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, the weather is gorgeous, indescribably beautiful. I'll be going up to the attic in a moment. I now know why I'm so much more restless than Peter. He has his own room, where he can work, dream, think, and sleep. I'm constantly being chased from one corner to another. I'm never alone in the room I share with Dussel, though I long to be so much. That's another reason I take refuge in the attic. When I'm there, or with you, I can be myself, at least for a little while. Still, I don't want to moan and groan. On the contrary, I want to be brave. Thank goodness the others notice nothing of my innermost feelings, except that every day I'm growing cooler and more contemptuous of Mother, less affectionate to Father, and less willing to share a single thought with Margot. I'm closed up tighter than a drum. Above all, I have to maintain my air of confidence. No one must know that my heart and mind are constantly at war with each other. Up to now, reason has always won the battle. But will my emotions get the upper hand? Sometimes I fear they will. But more often, I actually hope they do. Oh, it's so terribly hard not to talk to Peter about these things. But I know I have to let him begin. It's so hard to act during the daytime, as if everything I've said and done in my dreams had never taken place. Kitty, Anne is crazy, but then these are crazy times, and even crazier circumstances. The nicest part is being able to write down all my thoughts and feelings. Otherwise, I'd absolutely suffocate. I wonder what Peter thinks about all these things. I keep thinking I'll be able to talk to him about them one day. He must have guessed something about the inner me, since he couldn't possibly love the outer Anne he's known so far. How could someone like Peter, who loves peace and quiet, possibly stand my bustle and noise? Will he be the first and only person to see what's beneath my granite mask? Will it take him long? Isn't there some old saying about love being akin to pity? Isn't that what's happening here as well? Because I often pity him as much as I do myself. I honestly don't know how to begin. I really don't. So how can I expect Peter to when talking is so much harder for him? If only I could write to him. Then at least he'd know what I was trying to say, since it's so hard to say it out loud. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, March 17th, 1944. My dearest darling, everything turned out all right after all. Bep just had a sore throat, not the flu. And Mr. Kugler got a medical certificate to excuse him from the work detail. The entire annex breathed a huge sigh of relief. Everything's fine here, except that Margot and I are rather tired of our parents. Don't get me wrong. I still love Father as much as ever, and Margot loves both Father and Mother. But when you're as old as we are, you want to make a few decisions for yourself. Get out from under their thumb. Whenever I go upstairs, they ask what I'm going to do. They won't let me salt my food. Mother asks me every evening at 8:15 if it isn't time for me to change into my nightie, and they have to approve every book I read. I must admit they're not at all strict about that, and let me read nearly everything, but Margot and I are sick and tired of having to listen to their comments and questions all day long. There's something else that displeases them. I no longer feel like giving them little kisses morning, noon, and night. All those cute nicknames seem so affected, and Father's fondness for talking about farting and going to the bathroom is disgusting. In short, I'd like nothing better than to do without their company for a while, and they don't understand that. Not that Margot and I have ever said any of this to them. What would be the point? They wouldn't understand anyway. Margot said last night, "What really bothers me is that if you happen to put your head in your hands and sigh once or twice, they immediately ask whether you have a headache or don't feel well." For both of us, it's been quite a blow to suddenly realize that very little remains of the close and harmonious family we used to be at home. This is mostly because everything's out of kilter here. By that I mean that we're treated like children when it comes to external matters. Well, inwardly, we're much older than other girls our age. Even though I'm only 14, I know what I want. I know who's right and who's wrong. I have my own opinions, ideas, and principles, and though it may sound odd coming from a teenager, I feel I'm more of a person than a child. I feel I'm completely independent of others. I know I'm better at debating or carrying on a discussion than Mother. I know I'm more objective. I don't exaggerate as much. I'm much tidier and better with my hands, and because of that I feel, this may make you laugh, that I'm superior to her in many ways. To love someone, I have to admire and respect the person, but I feel neither respect nor admiration for Mother. Everything would be all right if only I had Peter, since I admire him in many ways. He's so decent and clever. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, March 18th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I've told you more about myself and my feelings than I've ever told a living soul, so why shouldn't that include sex? Parents, and people in general, are very peculiar when it comes to sex. Instead of telling their sons and daughters everything at the age of 12, they send the children out of the room the moment the subject arises and leave them to find out everything on their own. Later on, when parents notice that their children have, somehow, come by their information, they assume they know more, or less, than they actually do. So why don't they try to make amends by asking them what's what? A major stumbling block for the adults, though in my opinion it's no more than a pebble, is that they're afraid their children will no longer look upon marriage as sacred and pure once they realize that, in most cases, this purity is a lot of nonsense. As far as I'm concerned, it's not wrong for a man to bring a little experience to a marriage. After all, it has nothing to do with the marriage itself, does it? Soon after I turned 11, they told me about menstruation, but even then, I had no idea where the blood came from or what it was for. When I was 12 and a half, I learned some more from Jacques, who wasn't as ignorant as I was. My own intuition told me what a man and a woman do when they're together. It seemed like a crazy idea at first, but when Jacques confirmed it, I was proud of myself for having figured it out. It was also Jacques who told me that children didn't come out of their mother's tummies. As she put it, where the ingredients go in is where the finished product comes out. Jacques and I found out about the hymen and quite a few other details from a book on sex education. I also knew that you could keep from having children, but how that worked inside your body remained a mystery. When I came here, Father told me about prostitutes, etc., but all in all, there are still unanswered questions. If mothers don't tell their children everything, they hear it in bits and pieces, and that can't be right. Even though it's Saturday, I'm not bored. That's because I've been up in the attic with Peter. I sat there dreaming with my eyes closed, and it was wonderful. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Sunday, March 19th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, yesterday was a very important day for me. After lunch, everything was as usual. At 5, I put on the potatoes, and Mother gave me some blood sausage to take to Peter. I didn't want to at first, but I finally went. He wouldn't accept the sausage, and I had the dreadful feeling it was still because of that argument we'd had about distrust. Suddenly, I couldn't bear it a moment longer, and my eyes filled with tears. Without another word, I returned the platter to Mother and went to the bathroom to have a good cry. Afterward, I decided to talk things out with Peter. Before dinner, the four of us were helping him with a crossword puzzle, so I couldn't say anything. But as we were sitting down to eat, I whispered to him, "Are you going to practice your shorthand tonight, Peter?" "No," was his reply. "I'd like to talk to you later on." He agreed. After the dishes were done, I went to his room and asked if he'd refused the sausage because of our last quarrel. Luckily, that wasn't the reason. He just thought it was bad manners to seem so eager. It had been very hot downstairs, and my face was as red as a lobster. So after taking down some water for Margot, I went back up to get a little fresh air. For the sake of appearances, I first went and stood beside the Van Dan's window before going to Peter's room. He was standing on the left side of the open window, so I went over to the right side. It's much easier to talk next to an open window in semi-darkness than in broad daylight, and I think Peter felt the same way. We told each other so much, so very much, that I can't repeat it all. But it felt good. It was the most wonderful evening I've ever had in the annex. I'll give you a brief description of the various subjects we touched on. First, we talked about the quarrels, and how I see them in a very different light these days, and then about how we've become alienated from our parents. I told Peter about Mother and Father and Margot and myself. At one point he asked, "You always give each other a goodnight kiss, don't you?" "One? Dozens of them. You don't, do you?" "No, I've never really kissed anyone." "Not even on your birthday?" "Yeah, on my birthday I have."
We talked about how neither of us really trusts our parents, and how his parents love each other a great deal and wish he'd confide in them, but that he doesn't want to. How I cry my heart out in bed, and he goes up to the loft and swears. How Margot and I have only recently gotten to know each other, and yet still tell each other very little, since we're always together. We talked about every imaginable thing, about trust, feelings, and ourselves. Oh, Kitty, he was just as I thought he would be. Then we talked about the year 1942, and how different we were back then. We don't even recognize ourselves from that period. How we couldn't stand each other at first. He'd thought I was a noisy pest, and I'd quickly concluded that he was nothing special. I didn't understand why he didn't flirt with me, but now I'm glad. He also mentioned how he often used to retreat to his room. I said that my noise and exuberance and his silence were two sides of the same coin, and that I also liked peace and quiet but don't have anything for myself alone, except my diary, and that everyone would rather see the back of me, starting with Mr. Dussel, and that I don't always want to sit with my parents. We discussed how glad he is that my parents have children, and how glad I am that he's here. How I now understand his need to withdraw and his relationship to his parents, and how much I'd like to help him when they argue. "But you're always a help to me," he said. "How?" I asked, greatly surprised. "By being cheerful." That was the nicest thing he said all evening. He also told me that he didn't mind my coming to his room the way he used to. In fact, he liked it. I also told him that all of father's and mother's pet names were meaningless, that a kiss here and there didn't automatically lead to trust. We also talked about doing things your own way, the diary, loneliness, the difference between everyone's inner and outer selves, my mask, etc. It was wonderful. He must have come to love me as a friend, and, for the time being, that's enough. I'm so grateful and happy I can't find the words. I must apologize, Kitty, since my style is not up to my usual standard today. I've just written whatever came into my head. I have the feeling that Peter and I share a secret. Whenever he looks at me with those eyes, with that smile and that wink, it's as if a light goes on inside me. I hope things will stay like this, and that we'll have many, many more happy hours together. Your grateful and happy Anne. Monday, March 20th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, this morning Peter asked me if I'd come again one evening. He swore I wouldn't be disturbing him and said that where there was room for one, there was room for two. I said I couldn't see him every evening since my parents didn't think it was a good idea, but he thought I shouldn't let that bother me. So I told him I'd like to come some Saturday evening and also asked him if he'd let me know when you could see the moon. "Sure," he said. "Maybe we can go downstairs and look at the moon from there." I agreed. I'm not really so scared of burglars. In the meantime, a shadow has fallen on my happiness. For a long time, I've had the feeling that Margot likes Peter. Just how much, I don't know, but the whole situation is very unpleasant. Now, every time I go see Peter, I'm hurting her, without meaning to. The funny thing is that she hardly lets it show. I know I'd be insanely jealous, but Margot just says I shouldn't feel sorry for her. "I think it's so awful that you've become the odd one out," I added. "I'm used to that," she replied, somewhat bitterly. I don't dare tell Peter. Maybe later on, but he and I need to discuss so many other things first. Mother gave me a warning tap last night, which I deserved. I mustn't carry my indifference and contempt for her too far. In spite of everything, I should try once again to be friendly and keep my remarks to myself. Even Pym isn't as nice as he used to be. He's been trying not to treat me like a child, but now he's much too cold. We'll just have to see what comes of it. He's warned me that if I don't do my algebra, I won't get any tutoring after the war. I could simply wait and see what happens, but I'd like to start again, provided I get a new book. That's enough for now. I do nothing but gaze at Peter, and I'm filled to overflowing. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Evidence of Margot's goodness. I received this today, March 20th, 1944. Anne, yesterday when I said I wasn't jealous of you, I wasn't being entirely honest. The situation is this. I'm not jealous of either you or Peter.
I'm just sorry I haven't found anyone with whom to share my thoughts and feelings, and I'm not likely to in the near future. But that's why I wish, from the bottom of my heart, that you will both be able to place your trust in each other. You're already missing out on so much here, things other people take for granted. On the other hand, I'm certain I'd never have gotten as far with Peter, because I think I'd need to feel very close to a person before I could share my thoughts. I'd want to have the feeling that he understood me through and through, even if I didn't say much. For this reason, it would have to be someone I felt was intellectually superior to me, and that isn't the case with Peter. But I can imagine you're feeling close to him. So, there's no need for you to reproach yourself because you think you're taking something I was entitled to. Nothing could be further from the truth. You and Peter have everything to gain by your friendship. My answer. Dearest Margot, your letter was extremely kind, but I still don't feel completely happy about the situation, and I don't think I ever will. At the moment, Peter and I don't trust each other as much as you seem to think. It's just that when you're standing beside an open window at twilight, you can say more to each other than in bright sunshine. It's also easier to whisper your feelings than to shout them from the rooftops. I think you've begun to feel a kind of sisterly affection for Peter, and would like to help him, just as much as I would. Perhaps you'll be able to do that someday, though that's not the kind of trust we have in mind. I believe that trust has to come from both sides. I also think that's the reason why Father and I have never really grown so close. But let's not talk about it anymore. If there's anything you still want to discuss, please write, because it's easier for me to say what I mean on paper than face to face. You know how much I admire you, and only hope that some of your goodness and Father's goodness will rub off on me, because in that sense, you two are a lot alike. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, March 22nd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I received this letter last night from Margot. Dear Anne, after your letter of yesterday, I have the unpleasant feeling that your conscience bothers you whenever you go to Peter's to work or talk. There's really no reason for that. In my heart, I know there's someone who deserves my trust, as I do his, and I wouldn't be able to tolerate Peter in his place. However, as you wrote, I do think of Peter as a kind of brother, a younger brother. We've been sending out feelers, and a brotherly and sisterly affection may or may not develop at some later date, but it's certainly not reached that stage yet. So there's no need for you to feel sorry for me. Now that you've found companionship, enjoy it as much as you can. In the meantime, things are getting more and more wonderful here. I think, Kitty, that true love may be developing in the annex. All those jokes about marrying Peter if we stayed here long enough weren't so silly after all. Not that I'm thinking of marrying him, mind you. I don't even know what he'll be like when he grows up. Or if we'll even love each other enough to get married. I'm sure now that Peter loves me too. I just don't know in what way. I can't figure out if he wants only a good friend, or if he's attracted to me as a girl, or as a sister. When he said I always helped him when his parents were arguing, I was tremendously happy. It was one step toward making me believe in his friendship. I asked him yesterday what he'd do if there were a dozen Anns who kept popping in to see him. His answer was, if they were all like you, it wouldn't be so bad. He's extremely hospitable, and I think he really likes to see me. Meanwhile, he's been working hard at learning French, even studying in bed until 10:15. Oh, when I think back to Saturday night, to our words, our voices, I feel satisfied with myself for the very first time. What I mean is, I'd still say the same and wouldn't want to change a thing, the way I usually do. He's so handsome, whether he's smiling or just sitting still. He's so sweet and good and beautiful. I think that what surprised him most about me was when he discovered that I'm not at all the superficial worldly Anne I appear to be, but a dreamer like he is, with just as many troubles. Last night, after the dinner dishes, I waited for him to ask me to stay upstairs. But nothing happened. I went away. He came downstairs to tell Dussel it was time to listen to the radio and hung around the bathroom for a while, but when Dussel took too long, he went back upstairs. He paced up and down his room and went to bed early.
The entire evening I was so restless I kept going to the bathroom to splash cold water on my face. I read a bit, daydreamed some more, looked at the clock, and waited, 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 all the while listening to his footsteps. I went to bed early, exhausted. Tonight I have to take a bath, and tomorrow... tomorrow so far away. Yours, Anne M. Frank. My answer? Dearest Margot, I think the best thing is simply to wait and see what happens. It can't be much longer before Peter and I will have to decide whether to go back to the way we were or do something else. I don't know how it'll turn out. I can't see any farther than the end of my nose. But I'm certain of one thing. If Peter and I do become friends, I'm going to tell him you're also very fond of him, and are prepared to help him if he needs you. You wouldn't want me to, I'm sure, but I don't care. I don't know what Peter thinks of you, but I'll ask him when the time comes. It's certainly nothing bad. On the contrary, you're welcome to join us in the attic or wherever we are. You won't be disturbing us because we have an unspoken agreement to talk only in the evenings when it's dark. Keep your spirits up. I'm doing my best, though it's not always easy. Your time may come sooner than you think. Yours, Anne. Thursday, March 23rd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, things are more or less back to normal here. Our coupon men have been released from prison, thank goodness. Meep's been back since yesterday, but today it was her husband's turn to take to his bed. Chills and fever, the usual flu symptoms. Bep is better, though she still has a cough, and Mr. Kleiman will have to stay home for a long time. Yesterday a plane crashed nearby. The crew was able to parachute out in time. It crashed on top of a school, but luckily there were no children inside. There was a small fire, and a couple of people were killed. As the airmen made their descent, the Germans sprayed them with bullets. The Amsterdammers who saw it seethed with rage at such a dastardly deed. We, by which I mean the ladies, were also scared out of our wits. Brr, I hate the sound of gunfire. Now, about myself. I was with Peter yesterday, and somehow, I honestly don't know how, we wound up talking about sex. I'd made up my mind a long time ago to ask him a few things. He knows everything. When I said that Margot and I weren't very well informed, he was amazed. I told him a lot about Margot and me and Mother and Father and said that lately I didn't dare ask him anything. He offered to enlighten me, and I gratefully accepted. He described how contraceptives work, and I asked him very boldly how boys could tell they were grown up. He had to think about that one. He said he'd tell me tonight. I told him what had happened to Jacques, and said that girls are defenseless against strong boys. Well, you don't have to be afraid of me, he said. When I came back that evening, he told me how it is with boys. Slightly embarrassing, but still awfully nice to be able to discuss it with him. Neither he nor I had ever imagined we'd be able to talk so openly to a girl or a boy, respectively, about such intimate matters. I think I know everything now. He told me a lot about what he called Präsentivmittel in German. That night in the bathroom, Margot and I were talking about Brahm and Trace, two friends of hers. This morning I was in for a nasty surprise. After breakfast, Peter beckoned me upstairs. That was a dirty trick you played on me, he said. I heard what you and Margot were saying in the bathroom last night. I think you just wanted to find out how much Peter knew and then have a good laugh. I was stunned. I did everything I could to talk him out of that outrageous idea. I could understand how he must have felt, but it just wasn't true. Oh, no, Peter, I said. I'd never be so mean. I told you I wouldn't pass on anything you said to me, and I won't. To put on an act like that and then deliberately be so mean. No, Peter, that's not my idea of a joke. It wouldn't be fair. I didn't say anything, honest. Won't you believe me? He assured me he did. But I think we'll have to talk about it again sometime. I've done nothing all day but worry about it. Thank goodness he came right out and said what was on his mind. Imagine if he'd gone around thinking I could be that mean. He's so sweet. Now I'll have to tell him everything. Yours, Anne. Friday, March 24th, 1944. Dear Kitty, I often go up to Peter's room after dinner nowadays to breathe in the fresh evening air. You can get around to meaningful conversations more quickly in the dark than with the sun tickling your face. It's cozy and snug sitting beside him on a chair and looking outside. The Van Dans and Dussel make the silliest remarks when I disappear into his room.
Eine zweite Heimat, they say, or is it proper for a gentleman to receive young girls in his room at night with the lights out?
Peter has amazing presence of mind in the face of these so-called witticisms. My mother, incidentally, is also bursting with curiosity and simply dying to ask what we talk about, only she's secretly afraid I'd refuse to answer. Peter says the grown-ups are just jealous because we're young and that we shouldn't take their obnoxious comments to heart. Sometimes he comes downstairs to get me, but that's awkward too, because in spite of all his precautions, his face turns bright red and he can hardly get the words out of his mouth. I'm glad I don't blush. It must be extremely unpleasant. Besides, it bothers me that Margot has to sit downstairs all by herself while I'm upstairs enjoying Peter's company. But what can I do about it? I wouldn't mind if she came, but she'd just be the odd one out, sitting there like a lump on a log. I've had to listen to countless remarks about our sudden friendship. I can't tell you how often the conversation at meals has been about an annex wedding should the war last another 5 years. Do we take any notice of this parental chit-chat? Hardly, since it's all so silly. Have my parents forgotten that they were young once? Apparently, they have. At any rate, they laugh at us when we're serious, and they're serious when we're joking. I don't know what's going to happen next, or whether we'll run out of things to say. But if it goes on like this, we'll eventually be able to be together without talking. If only his parents would stop acting so strangely. It's probably because they don't like seeing me so often. Peter and I certainly never tell them what we talk about. Imagine if they knew we were discussing such intimate things. I'd like to ask Peter whether he knows what girls look like down there. I don't think boys are as complicated as girls. You can easily see what boys look like in a photograph or pictures of male nudes. But with women, it's different. In women, the genitals, or whatever they're called, are hidden between their legs. Peter has probably never seen a girl up close. To tell you the truth, neither have I. Boys are a lot easier. How on earth would I go about describing a girl's parts? I can tell from what he said that he doesn't know exactly how it all fits together. He was talking about the Muttermund, but that's on the inside, where you can't see it. Everything's pretty well arranged in us women. Until I was 11 or 12, I didn't realize there was a second set of labia on the inside, since you couldn't see them. What's even funnier is that I thought urine came out of the clitoris. I asked Mother one time what that little bump was, and she said she didn't know. She can really play dumb when she wants to. But to get back to the subject, how on earth can you explain what it all looks like without any models? Shall I try anyway? Okay, here goes. When you're standing up, all you see from the front is hair. Between your legs, there are two soft, cushiony things, also covered with hair, which press together when you're standing, so you can't see what's inside. They separate when you sit down, and they're very red and quite fleshy on the inside. In the upper part, between the outer labia, there's a fold of skin that, on second thought, looks like a kind of blister. That's the clitoris. Then come the inner labia, which are also pressed together in a kind of crease. When they open up, you can see a fleshy little mound, no bigger than the top of my thumb. The upper part has a couple of small holes in it, which is where the urine comes out. The lower part looks as if it were just skin, and yet, that's where the vagina is. You can barely find it because the folds of skin hide the opening. The hole is so small, I can hardly imagine how a man could get in there, much less how a baby could come out. It's hard enough trying to get your index finger inside. That's all there is, and yet it plays such an important role. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, March 25th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, you never realize how much you've changed until after it's happened. I've changed quite drastically. Everything about me is different. My opinions, ideas, critical outlook. Inwardly, outwardly, nothing's the same. And I might safely add, since it's true, I've changed for the better. I once told you that, after years of being adored, It was hard for me to adjust to the harsh reality of grown-ups and rebukes. But father and mother are largely to blame for my having to put up with so much. At home, they wanted me to enjoy life, which was fine, but here they shouldn't have encouraged me to agree with them and only shown me their side of all the quarrels and gossip. It was a long time before I discovered the score was 50-50. I now know that many blunders have been committed here, by young and old alike. Father and mother's biggest mistake in dealing with the Van Dans is that they're never candid and friendly. Admittedly, the friendliness might have to be feigned. Above all, I want to keep the peace, and to neither quarrel nor gossip. With father and Margot, that's not difficult, but it is with mother, which is why I'm glad she gives me an occasional rap on the knuckles. You can win Mr. Van Dan to your side by agreeing with him, listening quietly, not saying much, and most of all, responding to his teasing and his corny jokes with a joke of your own. Mrs. Van D can be won over by talking openly to her and admitting when you're wrong. She also frankly admits her faults, of which she has many. I know all too well that she doesn't think as badly of me as she did in the beginning, and that's simply because I'm honest and tell people right to their faces what I think, even when it's not very flattering. I want to be honest. I think it gets you further and also makes you feel better about yourself. Yesterday, Mrs. Van D was talking about the rice we gave Mr. Kleiman. All we do is give, 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 but at a certain point, I think that enough is enough. If he'd only take the trouble, Mr. Kleiman could scrounge up his own rice. Why should we give away all our supplies? We need them just as badly. No, Mrs. Van Dan, I replied. I don't agree with you. Mr. Kleiman may very well be able to get hold of a little rice, but he doesn't like having to worry about it. It's not our place to criticize the people who are helping us. We should give them whatever they need if we can possibly spare it. One less plate of rice a week won't make that much difference. We can always eat beans. Mrs. Van D didn't see it my way, but she added that, even though she disagreed, she was willing to back down, and that was an entirely different matter. Well, I've said enough. Sometimes I know what my place is, and sometimes I have my doubts. But I'll eventually get where I want to be. I know I will, especially now that I have help, since Peter helps me through many a rough patch and rainy day. I honestly don't know how much he loves me, and whether we'll ever get as far as a kiss. In any case, I don't want to force the issue. I told Father I often go see Peter and asked if he approved, and of course he did. It's much easier now to tell Peter things I'd normally keep to myself. For example, I told him I want to write later on, and if I can't be a writer, to write in addition to my work. I don't have much in the way of money or worldly possessions. I'm not beautiful, intelligent, or clever, but I'm happy, and I intend to stay that way. I was born happy. I love people. I have a trusting nature, and I'd like everyone else to be happy, too. Your devoted friend, Anne M. Frank. An empty day, though clear and bright, is just as dark as any night. I wrote this a few weeks ago, and it no longer holds true, but I included it because my poems are so few and far between. Monday, March 27th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, at least one long chapter on our life in hiding should be about politics, but I've been avoiding the subject since it interests me so little. Today, however, I'll devote an entire letter to politics. Of course, there are many different opinions on this topic, and it's not surprising to hear it frequently discussed in times of war, but arguing so much about politics is just plain stupid. Let them laugh, swear, make bets, grumble, and do whatever they want as long as they stew in their own juice. But don't let them argue, since that only makes things worse. The people who come from outside bring us a lot of news that later proves to be untrue. However, up to now, our radio has never lied. Jan, Meep, Mr. Kleiman, Bep, and Mr. Kugler go up and down in their political moods, though Jan least of all. Here in the annex, the mood never varies. The endless debates over the invasion, air raids, speeches, etc., etc., are accompanied by countless exclamations such as, "Impossible! Gottes Willen!" If they're just getting started now, how long is it going to last? It's going splendidly! Gut! Great! Optimists and pessimists, not to mention the realists, air their opinions with unflagging energy, and, as with everything else, they're all certain that they have a monopoly on the truth. It annoys a certain lady that her spouse has such supreme faith in the British, and a certain husband attacks his wife because of her teasing and disparaging remarks about his beloved nation. And so it goes from early in the morning to late at night. The funny part is that they never get tired of it. I've discovered a trick, and the effect is overwhelming, just like pricking someone with a pin and watching them jump. Here's how it works. I start talking about politics. All it takes is a single question, a word, or a sentence, and before you know it, the entire family is involved. As if the German Wehrmacht news and the English BBC weren't enough, they've now added special air raid announcements. In a word, splendid. But the other side of the coin is that the British Air Force is operating around the clock, not unlike the German propaganda machine, which is cranking out lies 24 hours a day. So the radio is switched on every morning at 8, if not earlier, and is listened to every hour until 9, 10, or even 11 at night. This is the best evidence yet that the adults have infinite patience, but also that their brains have turned to mush. Some of them, I mean, since I wouldn't want to insult anyone. One broadcast, two at the most, should be enough to last the entire day. But no, those old nincompoops. Never mind, I've already said it all. Music while you work. The Dutch broadcast from England, Frank Phillips or Queen Wilhelmina, they each get a turn and find a willing listener. If the adults aren't eating or sleeping, they're clustered around the radio talking about eating, sleeping, and politics. Whew, it's getting to be a bore, and it's all I can do to keep from turning into a dreary old crone myself. Though with all the old folks around me, that might not be such a bad idea. Here's a shining example, a speech made by our beloved Winston Churchill. 9 o'clock, Sunday evening. The teapot, under its cozy, is on the table, and the guests enter the room. Dussel sits to the left of the radio, Mr. Van D in front of it, and Peter to the side. Mother is next to Mr. Van D, with Mrs. Van D behind them. Margot and I are sitting in the last row, and Pim at the table. I realize this isn't a very clear description of our seating arrangements, but it doesn't matter. The men smoke. Peter's eyes close from the strain of listening. Mama is dressed in her long, dark negligee. Mrs. Van D is trembling because of the planes, which take no notice of the speech, but fly blithely on toward Essen. Father is slurping his tea, and Margot and I are united in a sisterly way by the sleeping Mushi, who has taken possession of both our knees. Margot's hair is in curlers, and my nightgown is too small, too tight, and too short. It all looks so intimate, cozy, and peaceful, and for once it really is. Yet I await the end of the speech with dread. They're impatient, straining at the leash to start another argument. Psst, psst, like a cat luring a mouse from its hole, they goad each other into quarrels and dissent. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, March 28th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, as much as I'd like to write more on politics, I have lots of other news to report today. First, Mother has virtually forbidden me to go up to Peter's, since, according to her, Mrs. Van Dan is jealous. Second, Peter's invited Margot to join us upstairs. Whether he really means it or is just saying it out of politeness, I don't know. Third, I asked Father if he thought I should take any notice of Mrs. Van Dan's jealousy, and he said I didn't have to. What should I do now? Mother's angry, doesn't want me going upstairs, wants me to go back to doing my homework in the room I share with Dussel. She may be jealous herself. Father doesn't begrudge us those few hours and thinks it's nice we get along so well. Margot likes Peter, too, but feels that three people can't talk about the same things as two. Furthermore, Mother thinks Peter's in love with me. To tell you the truth, I wish he were. Then we'd be even, and it'd be a lot easier to get to know each other. She also claims he's always looking at me. Well, I suppose we do give each other the occasional wink, but I can't help it if he keeps admiring my dimples, can I? I'm in a very difficult position. Mother's against me, and I'm against her. Father turns a blind eye to the silent struggle between Mother and me. Mother is sad because she still loves me, but I'm not at all unhappy
because she no longer means anything to me. As for Peter, I don't want to give him up. He's so sweet, and I admire him so much. He and I could have a really